Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
How were you supposed to read the translation of the work without looking at the intent of the author? And then a very, very heavy bias for how awful it is. 1 star. Okay. So I'm going to get my notes out.
Welcome everyone to the Tune Around Podcast. My name is Richard, and Austin is a little late.
My name's Austin, and we're talking about the death of the author. This article is the death of me. We're going to be completely unbiased in looking at this. I don't know what your thoughts are yet, Rich.
Yeah.
But I've been on a rampage after reading this article. And we're going to do 3 things in this episode. 1, give you some background information. What are we talking about here? Because this is an article written by Roland Barthes. I hope I'm saying his name correct. He's a French literary critic. Yeah, a lot of labels you could put on him. We're going to give the background information on this. Then we're going to discuss what is this essay we're talking about. It's called The Death of the Author. In French, it's L'Auteur de la Muerte or something like that.
Yeah,
and then during that and before that, but mainly after, we'll be giving personal opinions on the article. But I promise, we're also going to be here to say, what is the article saying? Take it as you will. And then a very, very heavy bias for how awful it is. 1 star. Okay, so I'm going to get my notes out. But hey, so you read the article today.
I did.
I read it a couple weeks ago. The anger's growing. Okay. Do you want to first give some background information, and then we'll kind of get into some stuff?
Oh, no. You completely take that from me. None of that. You're passing the ball to me. Well, no.
Okay, so here's the thing. The death of the author is it's an essay that defends the point that the author is important when interpreting a work. So you should look at an author when interpreting work. That's what this article is all about. And yeah,
it's the opposite of that.
No, but I think it's satirical. My interpretation of the work.
That's actually completely correct then.
Yeah. Yes. My interpretation is that I'm just being cheeky. Okay. Moving. I'm being cheeky with it.
I had the same joke.
You did?
I had the exact same joke. No. I thought the exact same thing.
I'm just being cheeky. Now, here's what I'll say as well. I'll caveat that as we talk about the article of what would Barth say in response to my criticism, because I've gone on a rabbit hole to every single point. Anyways, my point is this was written in French in 1967, I believe. Do I really not have the article? Yes, I do. It was written in 1967. And just to give, we'll give you some background information on what happened. But here's an important thing to remember as well when we're talking about the death of the author, which I promise we'll get to the point of what it is. But this was written in French, right?
Yes.
How did you read the article? Did you read it in French?
No, I don't speak French.
What'd you read it in? I'm just curious.
I read it in English.
That's interesting. So you read it in the English language?
Yep.
How do you... So the person that was translating this work from Roland Barthes, mm-hmm. what do you think they had to do when they were translating the work?
They had to read uh-huh. and then interpret.
What?
And then from their interpretation, present that to me.
They did. Now, but the author, I mean, do they interpret what the author is trying to say? Or do they just kind of look at the word and, you know, go all feelsy of what it is?
They look at the words, uh-huh. and as the reader, yeah. they get to express what they felt and experienced, because any interpretation that they have is equally as valid as the author's.
Now here's the thing. Barthes would say something to that. I've gone down a rabbit hole, Rich. Another cheeky point right. I'm making.
You know, let me actually get the point.
How were you supposed to read the translation of the work without looking at the intent of the author? It's not when you read something, you go, oh, I'm going to translate meditations and just, what is this word? Well, you look at, what did the author mean when they were saying this phrase so that I could translate the work properly so that someone could actually read the work? Otherwise, some translator could just go in and then look at, oh, I think Barthes is saying this, but how do I know what he's thinking? Well, you look at, what is the author's actual... Anyways, it's the translator paradox in a way of, in order to actually read this article in English, you have to read it from a translator who kept as honest as he possibly could of what was the intent of the essay from Roland Barthes to translate this in the first place. I'm already getting to the criticisms before the points of the article.
I thought you were a little bit more composed on this one, so I'm going to take over a second to give just pause.
Yep.
It's the beginning of the video, and we haven't even talked about what the actual thing is.
Oh, yeah.
Look.
Yeah.
The essay, The Death of the Author, basically covers two ideas. First is that nothing is original, and therefore, if nothing is original, if everything is an interpretation, a feeling, a rehash of something that came before, there is no originality. And if there is no originality, then the idea of something new and exotic, something special to the author, is overstated. And if that be the case, the idea of the author and the critic defining what a work is and what it means is limiting. And the real definition, the real argument of what some type of literature is defined by the reader. And so the last line of the essay is, well, you know, I could paraphrase or I could actually just fucking read it. I'm going to read it. All right. We are now beginning to be the dupes no longer of such antiphrases by which our society proudly champions precisely what it dismisses, ignores, smothers, or destroys. We know that to restore to writing its future, we must reverse its myth. The birth of the reader must be ransomed by the death of the author. The idea is the author's interpretation of the work is not as important, or at least not primarily and solely important, that the reader's interpretation of work is at least as valuable or more valuable than what it is given. That is the essay in a nutshell. There's other things to get into, but I think those are the two things. The concept of originality and of, if that be the case, what value does the author's interpretation of a work matter?
It sounds intelligent, especially when you think about it too, because this guy, just to give some background information on him, Roland Barthes, he was a French literary theorist, essayist, philosopher, critic, last word I can't really say, semiotician. And this essay, when he's writing, it's ironic that we're talking about him because he wouldn't want us to in The Death of the Author. He is a post-structuralist in this way, and he thought many things throughout his life, but this post-structuralist essay and at this time is also a response to the structuralist, which structuralist in this context, the structuralist identifies underlining structures and patterns within systems of language, culture, and society. So, for example, genre is a structural way of looking at things. And the post-structuralist, not to be synonymized with postmodernism, they overlap, but they're not the same. Postmodernism is more, in general, skepticism toward meta-narratives. That's usually a good way of surmising postmodernism.
This essay is also... Yep. Frequently credited as a critique of modern art and like postmodern kind of stuff, which I don't particularly think it is, but that's fine.
We'll also get into that, yeah. But we gave a quick summary. We're going to get into the details now. Okay, so the post-structuralist, they challenge the notion of fixed structures and meanings, arguing that meaning is unstable and fluid. So it's more so challenging the meaning of things, and the post-structuralist would look at the structures and say, like, that term of genre that you use, that itself is more fluid than you think it is. Okay, that's in general what post-structuralism is. And this is all different, just to give some history behind this. There was the New Criticism Movement, which is a school of literary criticism that was important in the U.S., at least from the 1940s to 1970s. Differs slightly from what Barthes is saying in this essay, but it's important to note that he's not the first to say the intent of the author doesn't matter. And he does say much more than that. If that's only what he was saying, I wouldn't be as vulgar today. So the New Criticism Movement, which there's an essay in 1946, so decades before he ever wrote this essay, there was an essay titled The Intentional Fallacy. This was an essay by W.K. Wimsatt and Monroe Beardsley. And in that essay, The Intentional Fallacy, they argued that a reader should not rely on the author's stated intent or beliefs to interpret a literary work. Instead, they argue that the meaning of a text is derived solely from the text itself, focusing on the internal coherence and structure rather than external factors like the author's biography and history. You can see the overlap. But The Intentional Fallacy talks about that, and we'll get into what this article, what the death of the author does on top of that, because they overlap in that way, but they are not the same. So, and one of those main things is that the intentional fallacy focuses on text more so, where the death of the author focuses on text, but reader as well. So the reader is of utmost importance when it comes to this essay's breakdown. So that's just some background information on what we're leading into in 1967. Put yourself in the shoes of Roland Barthes. You're pretentious. You think you know what you're doing. You're a pseudo-intellectual. Just put yourself in that. By the way, I'm also a pseudo-intellectual. Who am I to criticize this guy? Nobody. But I will. God damn it. A quick ad break from our sponsor of this episode, The Lord of the Rings.
A wonderful story about deliciously gray, villainous characters that are able to kill indiscriminately due to their nature of otherizing another race of people.
Oh my God. It's that morally gray ineptitude that is really complex about this character breakdown, that you think, why are they willing to kill these others completely indiscriminately, as you put? And it's just, the takeaway from the book is you just think, wow, what an incredibly invigorating thought process on the human psyche in that sense.
And ultimately, it is stemmed deep down in a great fear of the industrialization. It's why they're able to kill indiscriminately.
Back to the episode. So, getting into the thickums of the article, and I have like a 14-point thing to make of every reason I think that it's bollocks, but the article breakdown, it begins with an example, Rich, because to get into the meat of what you were saying about we can get into these more broad things. We'll now micro it down. It begins with an example about this thesis he has of why we can't really know what the author means or intends. And so this is the first thing. I'll read the first paragraph opening, and then you can interpret it from there, and we'll discuss. So he says this. Roland Barthes says this. The translator does. So hopefully the translator did a good job at reading the intent of him. Anyways, in his story, Sarenstein Balzac, sorry if I'm saying that wrong as well, speaking of Castrato disguised as a woman, writes this sentence. It was woman with her sudden fears, her irrational whims, her instinctive features, her unprovoked bravado, her daring and her delicious delicacy of feeling. Barthes then continues to say, this quote he's talking about, who is speaking in this way in the story? You know, is it the story's hero, concerned to ignore the castrato concealed beneath the woman? Is it the man Balzac, endowed by his personal experience with philosophy of woman? Is it the author Balzac? That's quite the name. Professing certain literary ideas of femininity? Is it universal wisdom, romantic psychology? He goes on, da-da-da, basically to say, he quotes, it is always impossible to know for the good reason that all writing is it itself is a special voice consisting of several indiscernible voices, dot, dot, dot. Basically is giving this example of going, how do we actually know what this means here? So how do you interpret his start there? And he's given an example of why he's writing this essay. What do you think his frame is here?
I think there's what he is touching on here and the article as a whole.
Yeah,
I think does have a nugget of truth in the idea of absence the author's intention, how are you supposed to interpret a work? I mean, if you don't know, absence of any knowledge, what is the true interpretation of a work? I think it's valid in that situation that your whatever interpretation that comes closest to, and this maybe this is where I'm at, whatever interpretation is closest to the actual intention is the point. But you can still have, you any individual can have their own interpretation of the work.
Yeah.
Like, it can be valid. It can be insightful. It can be its own point on its own. And it's an inspiration, just like everything in this article talked about originality. Mm-hmm. But what he's getting at is, I think, falsely assuming that it is impossible to ever know the author's intention on any work, which I feel is kind of silly. That's not true in most regards.
Here's a good example. If he's saying in this text, he's saying there's a line here. It was a woman with her sudden fears, her rational whims, dot, dot, dot. What he's saying in that first paragraph is, how do we know if the author is pontificating about the author's thoughts of woman? How do we know if it's the character's thoughts about woman? How do we know if it's the author thinking this is what other people think about woman? He's going, it's impossible to know in that sense of what does the author mean. There's a, I didn't come up with this or think this through, but Eric Wayne online gave a funny example or a good example of this, of what you would think when you hear this. When you hear the song, Mama Just Killed a Man. When you hear that, you go like, I'm pretty sure that wasn't Freddie Mercury who killed the man. I'm pretty sure we could figure out it's the fucking fictional character he's talking about. But obviously, just a funny example there. Promise we're going to get more serious. No, we're not.
Never.
So he is saying then, when on page, the voice loses its origin. And again, when I'm reading this article here, coming into this, here's my background information. This article is used a lot of times to defend separating the art from the artist, which is a separate conversation. We'll include this afterwards as well. They're separate things. This article, how I knew about it as well, my general thoughts were, oh, okay, death of the author means that their intent isn't final. You can interpret things how you will, and that's just as valid. That's kind of the colloquial knowledge I had of it. And again, the intentional fallacy that article referred to earlier, there are other ones that do say that. Here's where he goes a step further, because he makes specific arguments, and the more he got into the weeds of what he meant by this article, not the colloquial term, you know, people say death of the author, because when people say that term, they might mean different things. In this article, what he goes on to say is that there's a historical argument that he makes. He sets up the background, and he says that societies throughout history have used a mediator, a shaman, a reciter, not the author. They've used some reciter to tell this tale and pass it down through time, which intuitively also makes sense. Because you remember that section of the essay where he's saying, hey, look back to, as he says, the Middle Ages, that the Middle Ages inflicted by English empiricism, French rationalism, and the personal faith of the Reformation, all of these, this modern character has kind of been developed by these different movements, by the English empiricism, French rationalism, that the author matters so much. But they kind of lost the way where, look back to ancient times when a tale was told, we don't know who the author is. They're just telling some tale of some mythos and of some god or of some local legend. It's not necessarily the author saying, because they're not, they're just passing down the tale. So you remember that portion? Did you have any significant thoughts there?
I do. I mean, it's the idea of stories over time through interpretation, through retelling, can alter and change its meaning, which obviously, like, that is valid and true, but it also doesn't discredit completely what the origin is. Like, the origin is still the origin. I don't know. I would consider a new interpretation if someone takes the story of, I don't know, you take the Greek pantheon and they retell it. Well, that now has a new author who told the story. That, and what was their intent? What was their changes in, or their interpretation of it? That is what they meant by it. There is some degree of understanding from someone's reinterpretation, and therefore it changes. So he's trying to get past the idea that there was a time where we disregarded authors entirely and that the author didn't exist. And it's not true. Interpretation always, even in those oral retellings, those orators had an intention.
Orators, but yeah.
Orators, did yeah. I? What'd I say?
Orator. Like the Terminator. I get it. I would have said the same thing.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
the point he's making there, I get intuitively what he's thinking there. He's thinking, okay, this is how stories were told in the past. And like I said at the beginning, I'll make more of this point at the end so it makes more sense. But the translation of this work we're reading in English. We are reading a translation of the original French. The goal of a translator should always be full stop. What did the author mean? Because if you're trying to translate a text and you're just going like, okay, I'll kind of translate this from how I interpret it myself without considering the author, you're doing translation wrong. So that's why I see the big contradiction here in the first place is the contradiction of this article is you cannot read this article in English with actually taking his point, because his argument would then be you're left in interpretive paralysis, because how am I supposed to interpret something that is an interpretation of an interpretation that isn't seeking the true author's intent? So yeah. those tales that are passed through time of some legend, some folklore, the original tale is probably different and it's told differently. Brings on a new meaning in a different way from depending on the author who's telling it.
A simple thing that maybe a lot of people would understand, and it's a point that I think everyone would know, is look at Disney stories of classic fairy tales.
Yep.
The classic fairy tales often have maybe similar points and intentions and moral lessons, but often very different. And I would say are different stories compared to what Disney decides to produce. And wonderful stories as they are, the originals of all their fairy tales, not the remakes. But point being is both have interpreters, both have authors with intent, and you can judge them as such. What did what did Walt Disney intend by telling this story and changing it the way they did? What is the message? What was it? You do have to have an understanding of the intent. That's the whole point. We write to be understood. If we write just to like put it on a page and never actually be understood, and that the person reading it, however they interpret it, is just as valid as the person writing it, then we're left with nonsense. They can take the opposite meaning and it's like, okay, why did I write this thing? I am not understood.
Though the argument from Barthes' perspective there is when an author could intend something and it just doesn't work. You read the text and you're going, okay, yeah, you intended this to be good, but it's bad. And look, because the Arbarus's perspective is read it for the text there. And this is why I was kind of being cheeky at the beginning and saying, oh, I interpret it as a satire. My point of saying I interpret it as a satire is because here would be my argument following Barthes' logic, because I want to steel man it. Barthes would say not all interpretations are valid. He is not saying that you could subjectively view anything for however you want. Barthes is specifically saying, and this is where I want to give credit to not misinterpret him, he is specifically saying that reader's interpretation is valid so long as the text supports it. So he's not saying you could read this article here and then say it's talking about puppies because where are puppies mentioned, or it really means this. Now you can, if it's backed up by the text, he would say it is. Now the issue with that
The idea of what is backed up by the text is down to interpretation of
so it can
people
get more,
can twist logic and language into any tangle of knots they want.
Which I have tons of examples. I'll kind of get ahead of ourselves, then come back to the article. So are we going to weave back and forth? Because as we're talking about the point, but Barthes, when he's saying you have to interpret here. So my cheeky claim of, well, I think he's defending authorial intent, which is the opposite of what he's actually saying. I could interpret this text and go, it comes across as extremely satirical to me because I think the claims he is making are so absurd. Obviously, it's satire and my interpretation is valid. Now, Barthes would probably say, good, you are interpreting correctly. You're following the rules correctly. Now, to which I would say, well, that's kind of ridiculous because I'm obviously saying the satirical point to push back on for the argument's sake and just make the point that ethereal intent has some matter to it, or at least text and history does, because the point I disagree the absolute most with what he says, and this is the key. This is the key here to where I think his argument falls apart. He says that he argues in the article 2 points, that it's a historical fact of the removal of the author, which we brought up, and 2, it's the act of writing. He says this. The modern scripter is born at the same time as his text. He is not furnished with a being which precedes or exceeds his writing. He is not the subject of which his book would be the predicate. Now, here's the key. There is no time other than that of the speech act, and every text is written eternally here and now. Eternally here and now is the key. He looks at a text, and he doesn't just take away the author. He takes historical context out of it. He takes away any sort of origin. His argument is that the text originates with the language you're reading right now and in the moment. It lives right now. There's nothing before this moment you read this text. There's no moment before you're listening to me speaking these words that exist. You have to look at just that, not even just the author's past, when it was written, which has so many. Oh, go ahead, Rich. Yeah.
Well, no, that disregards almost every form of human understanding and progression through science, literature, and culture. All different aspects is to learn to grow, you must have a foundation of what has come before you.
Yeah.
Duh.
Just for one example, which I get, sorry, Rich, I'm taking the mic on this one for a little bit. But,
no, this was your... You told me, read this. I have things to say.
I have a lot to say. Here's one. Okay, I'm going to jump ahead again and give some of my criticism, then we'll go back into the article. One of the reasons why this is stupid is if you look at any sort of historical text, it is necessary to understand the origin and history of it, and words in many regards. Meditations, for example. If you read Meditations, the book, and have no understanding whatsoever, no context, and you're going to read this going, oh, these are kind of ramblings with no narrative, and it's just strange. Why are there's no structure to this. Okay, that's weird. Well, then if you kind of find out this was an emperor of Rome, and he was writing these musings, and everybody knows Meditations. It is incredibly important to know that to meaningfully engage with the text in any sort of way. If you read Meditations with literally no historical knowledge when this was written, you're losing the tracks. And in the same way, I would say there's two other great examples. One of them I came up with, one of them a friend did. I'll say the one I did first was if you're to read any type of novel, say from 1800 in America to then today in 2025, and there's a slave-owning family or something like that, or maybe say 1700s, 1800s, whatever. If you're to read that and there's a character with that is a slave-owning family, in today's context, you read that and reading it in 2025 that the author's probably not advocating for it, and the slave-owning family, like, okay, that's villainous stuff, antagonist over there. If you read it in 1750 and it's an author, Confederate, and they have this in there, the author's thinking, oh, that's not a bad thing in their moral structure and their context. And yes, to that 1750 author, to them, that's normal thing. But today we'd read that and go like, oh, that's the villain of the story. Oh, you'd automatically have a reaction. But if you know the author's context of what was even moral at the time, that's also important to understanding the text. And then an example that a friend Harry gave me was Shakespeare. Today we read that as incredibly highbrow of look at all this fancy language. When Shakespeare was writing this, it was peasant words and knowledge. It was written for the everyday person, but today it's, oh, look how fancy Shakespeare is, which is how we look, but it's important to put that into context.
It's a very fun aspect of Shakespeare. In high school, when you read Shakespeare, which mm-hmm. terrible way to consume Shakespeare, watch the plays. Don't just read it.
Yeah.
I implore all high schools, stop doing that. Stop making kids just read Shakespeare. Terrible. Beside the point, a lot of high schoolers will see Romeo and Juliet as, oh, it's the classic romance story, and it's supposed to be romantic. No, it wasn't. It is a comedy in jest of like, look how stupid young people are in love. It's not the point. Like, Shakespeare's point wasn't, oh yes, this is the right expression of love and this is how love should be. It is, hey, look, two young idiots, and this is what dumb young love is, and everyone can kind of relate to that. Of, ah, yes, I remember when I was that young and how I interpreted love. It's funny. It's a point. Same thing with Hamlet. Hamlet's actually incredibly funny, even though a lot of people in high school will say, oh, it's one of the darker plays from Shakespeare. No, it's actually really funny if you watch the play.
Even reading it versus seeing it played is very different.
Yes. But all of that is you could have an impression of a work without the historical context, and that's fine. But you wouldn't be able to say that you understand the work. To understand the work means, what did the author mean? What was the point? It's just wrong.
And I would even go as far to say this, of you can we subjectively feel things, and hey, I like this story more than this. This one affected me more, da-da-da. And you can even use it just backing up the text of saying, which we'll get into separating art versus artists a little bit later, but when you're reading something, you could look at an author's piece and go, oh my God, that's horrible. Okay, I'll give two examples. Sorry I'm butchering this, but two examples of this. The movie The Room. Obviously, Tommy Wiseau, when he was writing The Room, intended to have a drama and like, oh, this is I'm writing a great film that is going to be very drama-filled and intense. And you watch The Room and it's comical. It's a cult classic because he was trying to make a good movie and it's very bad. And that's what maybe makes it good.
Yeah.
So you look at that, even though Tommy Wiseau's intent did not get pulled off, I would argue that also the fact that his intent was to make it good is what makes you engage with the work in a way that is better literary or film criticism, because knowing what the author's going for and whether they hit that or not doesn't have to change whether you like it or not. It's just a part of the literary criticism portion of the equation, where let's say then an author writes something and it's kind of, they don't necessarily think this piece of it's going to move you, or that's not their main goal. Maybe you use this as an analogy to your relationship with your mother, or you take a work and you go, okay, this work is saying this, but man, it hits me in this different way. All that's completely valid. The argument back to Barthes is that AI or a blanket slate language isn't originating this. The reason you are moved isn't because of just the word on page, but an author either consciously or subconsciously wrote something that was able to move you. That's just my argument back to him, because even if you related this relationship with your mother and you found all this meaning out of it, well, yes, the text did that, and the text was able to do that because the author... it didn't just spawn like a mini. Each word is not a miniature Big Bang. It's not, each word isn't a god that just spawns. That's not what language is. There is a creator behind the language, and that is why you're able to feel this way, because, again, it could be unintentionally. An author doesn't... not everything's intentional. Actually, question to you, Rich, to lob it up. Are the curtains blue?
That classic one. Yeah. Yes. It's... you can over... intend something. It is very possible to speak meaning into something the author did not intend.
Yeah.
Totally possible. But that's part of the exploration of the text. What did the author mean? And you can be wrong. But asking the question is still a valid... to understand a text, you have to understand the intention. And then after that is when you can have interpretation. Excising the responsibility of trying to understand the intention, I see as very lazy.
Here's another example too. Laws. When you're writing a law, and you do this in, we're in the US, but you could do this in any country whatsoever. When you're interpreting a law and looking back to something that was written hundreds of years ago, even decades ago, you read the text and it's important to go, okay, what did our predecessors mean by this law? Hey, it's okay to go legislate, and you could go try to change that law and go like, this is the thing that we want to do. Hey, I vote for this. This is what I want to change. But it's important when looking even at legal or historical documents to go, okay, what was the intent? What did they mean? So that we know how to apply it. If we don't like that, okay, let's try to change it. But the important aspect of this is you don't read the text and go, okay, I'm reading this word. This is what the word means to me here and now in the moment. Here's my interpretation.
But when it was written, it meant the opposite.
Right. And so how can you apply legal systems if you're just going to change what the words mean over time because of your eternally here and now? Stupid. Because I want to extend it to this of...
That is a legal argument that is like... that is quite popular in the States, and it is... not just like, oh, a difference of opinion. It's a factually incorrect interpretation of law. If law is just subjective, whatever you interpret to mean as of the day, and the same law can mean the opposite thing just with the difference of time, then we have no law. There is no such thing as law then. Then it is just the whims of the people in power. That's all it is. Then why bother having a law at that point?
And to give, sorry, to go more into this, right? This example, why it's so important, because that this is where, again, this is where the article pissed me off, where he's, I'm going to repeat his line here. I'll repeat the line and go back to this point. He says, there is no time other than that of the Speech Act, and every text is written eternally here and now. And there's context around this. We're going to keep going back into the article, okay? But the fact that it's eternally here and now, here's another reason. And there's so many examples of why it's wrong. Here's another. If we're to stay on the politics realm, not getting political about it, but just think of terms. When somebody says right-wing extremist, left-wing extremist, leftist, woke, all these buzzwords, even here and now today, I don't even know what you mean by some of those words. Like, well, left versus liberal, right versus conservative, even those words.
But that's the point, is so much discourse is basically breaks down because of misunderstanding of someone says one word, the other person interprets that word as, oh, this is what you meant by it. And that person will go, no, I didn't mean it that way. I meant it this way. And basically discussion breaks down. Ultimately, language exists as a mechanism to be understood by another.
Mm-hmm.
If it fails, if a word causes a language fails at demonstrating understanding, then the word has failed, or the reader has failed to understand,
or the author failed.
But anyone ultimately, could be there, yeah. It is a tool to understand. Yeah. It is a tool to communicate ideas. Mm-hmm. If the idea is not communicated properly, it's a breakdown of the interpreter's background, understanding, history. There, like, do they know the definition of the word? Do they know? That's the point. If language exists on, like, language doesn't exist on its own to be interpreted.
It's just interpreted by the reader for what the text says. That's what it exists here.
Language exists as a tool to be understood by others, for people to understand each other, which is the entire point. So the author, the whole death of the author, Roland saying, like, that the text stands on its own is, it disregards the whole point of language,
yeah.
The whole point of literature. We're going to take a quick break from the video to talk about our sponsor, A Game of Thrones,
ooh,
book one of A Song of Ice and Fire.
This is an inspirational tale about how romance can exist at any age. Whether you're a child marrying some big call, it's just as fruitful and a loving relationship. This, obviously, in the text, it doesn't afterwards go into the details of why this is wrong. Or it just kind of shows how this love and age is just a number. Parody! We'll see you back.
Parody! For the love of God! Parody!
Okay, we'll see you back in the episode. Take, for example, how would a Roland Barthes, and here's why it's bad for criticism as well, or even look at, again, this post-structuralist idea he has is that things are fluid and you can't really find the true meaning of it. So that's the premise he's going off of since there's different interpretations, you can't find, there's no objective truth to this word. Now, if somebody was to say the word right-wing extremist, left-wing extremist, right now, even when you say the word leftist versus liberal, people mean different things by that, especially if you're in the U.S., if you're in England.
Oh, yeah.
It gets very different for what you mean by these words. And so let's say an easier example is a movie that you and I both love. And this is not really spoilers for it. It's just a scene in the movie. It's been around since the 50s, 12 Angry Men. One of the arguments made in this court case from the main character is that the person on trial, it's used against them in court that they said the word something like, I'll kill you, something like that. And the person that's defending the person on trial and arguing in favor of them says, well, you know, people joke around all the time saying, I'll kill you. Like, hey, I'll get you, buddy.
How many times in anger have you yelled at someone, I'm going to kill you for that.
But didn't mean it.
And didn't mean it. And you actually didn't kill them. And then on the flip side is like, well, the person shouted, I'm going to kill you. And then an hour later, the person ends up dead. Don't you think
that
we should?
Means more.
That means more in the context of what actually happened. Does that matter?
Right.
Yeah. But the interpretation, do we always mean the words that we say?
Yes.
Yeah. It's what are your intentions?
So essentially he's taking out of this equation are the intentions, the origin, the historical context of the words itself, which breaks down in legal terms, breaks down in not just buzzwords, but really all language can be misinterpreted, interpreted differently. Historical context with things like meditations or any other historical. We just read it recently, so I'm bringing that up as an example. But want to get back to article, then we can weave back into the next 10 bullet points of criticism.
That's
That's just the surface layer. Because I also want to make sure while we're doing this that Steel Manning and representing Barth's argument properly, because do you want to discuss anything here? Give him the benefit of the doubt of making sure that this is what he means. Again, this is also...
Yeah, who knows?
Actually, even if we're misinterpreting this whole thing...
He can't... he's dead, but he can't review it. So...
Which, again, brings you in that kind of... That paralysis of there are... Okay, Barth, again, isn't saying that every interpretation is just as valid. You have to use a text to support it. You have to go, okay, puppies didn't just fly in the air in this essay because where were the puppies? Where's the air? Da-da-da. Using textual and contextual support to discuss and interpret
it is the main thing.
That
is ultimately Barth is saying that language and literature, words, exist outside of human understanding and is ultimately almost like a being in of itself, and that it is not necessarily the tool of humans, that, you know, the human is the tool of language, and that because nothing is original, that the human, you know, man, the author is not creating anything new, but simply reinterpreting ideas, experiences, and text from their own experiences, that it's not them, it's their previous text that they are reinterpreting and imagining to something new. And so it is taking the authority of the author and subsequently, like, no, it's actually the previous history and text is the actual author of this new text. And basically,
language
is language. And the new language is just inspired from previous language and taking the author out completely.
It's just language.
Yes.
And what do you think? So another point he's making here, I won't go into each person, but he references other authors and other critics who, I'm sorry, I don't know the background of these characters, but there's Mallarmé, Valéry, and these others who kind of, he's building off of their arguments, because I'll give another piece of his criticism. What Barth is saying is he says criticism still largely consists, he's saying in the modern day, and this is 1960s, still happens today, is saying that Baudelaire's over, sorry, I'm not right on that.
We're American. We speak American, yeah, and that's about it.
Is the failure of the man, and so Van Gogh is his madness, da-da-da. I'll contextualize this because I said it a little bit out of context. He's saying that people will say Van Gogh's art piece Starry Night, for example, is because of Van Gogh's madness. Well, how sure are we of that? Barth makes a good point, I'd say, to, okay, how can we just attribute that then? Does that just defeat interpretation of what if that wasn't the case? What if Van Gogh's madness, maybe that's a simple way of looking at why he did this, and that people are looking too much into this circle jerk of looking into the authorship. And he gets at critics, and he actually pinpoints why the life of the author is also the life of the critic. Because if the author has this meaning that you have to discover and kind of detective throughout, if there's a detective work to the author's intent, it gives critics a place in the literary circle to have the circle jerk of going, oh, we have to figure out what the author means. And that means our jobs are valid.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Valuable, because if there's some meaning, that means we have to figure it out for these readers. You know, they're the through line from that author to reader to let the public know. And so that's a lot of why he's also saying that the life of the author, and why it's so prevalent as well, is also the life of the critic. What do you think about his point there on critics and critics being the coattails of authors being important?
I mean, he is right in that instance of, for critics to exist, there does have to be some idea that the author has an intention and has a meaning. If the author truly doesn't matter, and that there is no right interpretation, and it only matters what the reader interprets, then he's right. The critic doesn't matter. I mean, that is a valid point. It's just we disagree that the author actually kind of does matter to the point of a work. No, he's right.
Yeah, and so that criticism he makes, I was like, oh, you know what? I like when we get a little punch back to us. What a movie that I love is The Menu. If you've seen The Menu. Oh, yeah, we watched The Menu together.
We watched it together, yes.
It's so awesome because it criticizes critics. And I will give it, it's amazing. It's Gordon Ramsay on steroids.
Yes.
And so that point he makes about the life of the critic. Then, again, the issue I have with that is, then if it comes to reader's interpretation, then the reader also becomes
the critic.
So it just brings it, it's the same thing. It's like, okay, sure, the critic's not, but then the reader interprets it, and the reader says, hey, this is my interpretation of the work. Someone tells this, and they're like, oh, no,
it defeats the purpose of, if you remove any attempt at understanding, then there is, I mean, you're left with nothing. Why bother writing?
Yes, and he says, the term he uses is deciphering the text, and he says, to your point earlier about language just being language, he says, words can be explained only through other words, and this ad infinitum. Which, yes, words just are explained through other words, but those words are being expressed by somebody.
and so generally, words don't necessarily... go back down. He's wrong to some degree of
ad infinitum.
It's not words can only be explained by other words. No, at a certain point, words are impressions. That the reason why you can teach a child how to speak is because you have associated a child's visual, auditory, any type of sensory impression to a word. That is language. It is a tool to be understood. It's not words just describing words and words exist on their own. No, at a certain point, the word milk applies not just, oh, it's lactose or the liquid that, you know, liquid that comes out of a female cow and all this, like, yeah, you can describe words that way.
Or goats.
But ultimately,
or a lot of mammals. But
whatever. But the point is, milk is also, to the child, that liquid that tastes that certain way. And that's what it is. The white liquid that tastes a certain way to me. That is milk. And I've explained it with words, but also, if you've drank milk before, so sorry. Then you know what I mean. It's... milk is not the word. Milk is the object in reality.
It's an expression.
It's an expression.
Yes. What are you trying to express by saying milk? And then you can get, you can, yes, use other words to explain other words.
But
because that's our way of expressing things.
But that's the fun thing about this. You can almost prove him wrong in this statement. If words truly are just... explained by other words, and there is no actual truth to it. It is all just infinitely back of words, expressions of other words, and that's all you can say about language. Then ultimately, if someone who has never drank milk before, that actually is kind of true. Someone tells you milk, and you go, well, what's milk? And then you keep using words to understand, but ultimately the person has never drank it, never experienced it, never seen it, then you're right. It is nonsense.
Describing color green to a blind person.
Yeah, it ultimately, to them, can never be properly interpreted.
Yeah.
But that's...
How do you explain green? If words do explain words, which means that person who is colorblind had never experienced green before, literally doesn't have the ability to sense what you're talking about.
Yep. And through language, we can interpret our expressions, our experiences into another person's mind. Our third sponsor of today's video.
Oh my goodness.
A Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas.
This is a story all about how reading is holding you back. If you want to be the true hero of your Tao, you just have to become illiterate. The less read you are, the more you'll be the protagonist and find your own fairy love out there. And that is just what's stopping you. Stop reading all. Become the hero you were always meant to be. And this is the conclusion and the most important part about the article to sum up his points. Then we can get all into the rest of this stuff.
So
this is the conclusion part. He says, essentially, there's no inherent meaning, ultimate meaning to text. And he says, I quote, "The space of writing is to be traversed, not pierced. Writing constantly posits meaning, but always in order to evaporate it." Then he continues on saying, "The unity of a text is not in its origin, but in its destination. But this destination can no longer be personal. The reader is a man without history, without biography, without psychology. He is only that someone who holds collected into one and the same field all the traces from which writing is constituted." Now, that portion of what he just said there is what we were talking about with the writer. I'll quote him, says, "The destination can no longer be personal." So that's what I was talking about earlier of, hey, just because you feel this is an analogy to your mom and you feel certain ways and you're this, you're that, in a way, it's kind of ironic because he says the birth of the reader is the death of the author, but also the reader can't take their personal feelings into it. You have to still, his focus is reader is interpreter for text. However, don't use your own personal bias to say, just because I feel this way about what it means, that it means this. He's saying, still read the text for the language itself, which is in and of itself just language. So it's a more complicated way of putting it. I'll finish with this is the last thing he says. You said it earlier, the last thing he says, the birth of the reader must be requited by the death of the author. And to summarize the central two claims, it's one, origin of text doesn't matter. It lives here and now. And that two, the reader's an interpreter of meaning based on the text available. So, reader interpretive meaning based on text available, and the origin of text does that matter lives here and now. Those central claims, which Barthes makes, is probably a bit different to what you hear colloquially, sorry, I'm butchering that, in the zeitgeist of what people say, hey, I believe in the death of the author because I think reader interpretation is important, and just because an author is going for something is different than exactly what Barthes is going for here.
It seems like a lot of this is colloquially. It is understood in the sense of the binary of only the author's intention matters or only the reader's intention matters.
Yeah.
Barth is going on the one side of it in many ways, even in his last statement, is being, it's not just the reader's personal interpretation that matters. It is the text itself, which, point being, but... I think this essay is probably used in ways of saying, like, hey, look, a reader's interpretation of a work also matters in addition to the author. But Barth is making the other, like, other extreme of only the reader matters, not the author. And I just find that silly.
Especially when he says that reader's interpretation matters. Well, what reader? Right, Joe Abercrombie famously called me a bad reader.
True.
So if you were to give this text to a toddler,
what is a reader without their experience and bringing in the personal?
Exactly. So he is saying he's asking an impossible task of where you can't bring in your own personal. You are no longer. I will again quote him. So we're making sure we're steel manning what he's saying. He is saying, the destination can no longer be personal. The reader is a man without history, without biography, without psychology. Everything he's asking for in this interpretation is already impossible because he is asking the reader to also be a blank slate, and people are their origins as well. People are what experiences they've had, how their intelligence levels, their ability to actually understand words on the page. Because if you're going to give your toddler a text, of course they're going to interpret something completely different. They can't understand some of the words, or they mean something different. Again, same reason that you ask somebody from the 1800s to read this text versus today, you're going to get different interpretations. And so he's asking you, the reader, to not let it be personal, but at the same time, life and experience is incredibly personal. He's saying the language itself that's written on page has the origin is the language itself. Take away the history of the author, and also you, reader,
take away your own history.
Your own history.
You need to read the words and interpret it in and of itself. Yeah.
So he's what he's asking here is just impossible as well. Yeah. So I'm trying to make sure. So did you also interpret it this way? Is there something about what Barthes is saying here of, are we giving him full credit? That's what he means.
I mean,
is that what the text means?
Ultimately, I think the text supports our interpretation of it.
Yeah, it's satirical, right?
God. But that's the point. Yeah. You have to, us trying to ask the question, mm-hmm, of what did Barthes mean by this, mm-hmm, is the point of an essay. The point of an essay is to be, yep, I want these thoughts to be understood by somebody else. That's the goddamn point.
What's the point of pushing back on this article? Let's say this whole entire time we misinterpreted something, on maybe we just got it wrong. What did the text actually say? Or we got something completely wrong.
We're barking at windmills at that point.
So why look at something and have any sort of, where's the conversation to be had, mm-hmm, if that's the point of conversation? and so I know we went over a couple things from some of the translator paradox. Anyways, there's a couple other things. What it seems to do here is removes author agency entirely. And a good point of this is with AI writing text as well. If the AI, mm-hmm, just kind of pushes out and slops something out there, there's inherently, if I'm reading something created by AI versus a human being, already there's inherently a different meaning to it. There's inherently, I attribute more value to the thing made by human than the thing made by AI. Even though it could affect, maybe the thing about AI makes me cry and tear up and oh my goodness. But do you think we as humans attribute value differently to if it originated from a human being rather than originating from AI?
I think it's a really good point to bring up, because AI, how generally AI, these large language models actually work, is it's all about patterns and reinterpreting and just, combining different ideas, mm-hmm, together, and the odds of what is most likely to be the next word or, sequence of letters that would be in this position.
Right.
But ultimately, it is devoid of meaning. It is just combining different things together in the most comprehensible way to humans.
Mm.
But ultimately, there is no understanding. The computer does not understand the words it is saying. And ultimately, then, it is a tool. It is a tool without without a master, without a controller. And yeah, what's the point? What's the point of a hammer if no one holds it? And so reading is, you're right.
Art is an expression.
Art is an expression. If art is done without someone to express it, then yeah, it's kind of pointless.
Precisely. Here's another thing with the agency. Maybe this is more of a silly example. Analogous to, if it just takes away the agency of the author, where the origin is the text, the origin is not actually the author. Think of that sense in the real world of how often does a murder happen and you go, man, let's look into this knife, or not, let's figure out why this knife did it. Intuitively, you don't look for the knife, the word. You look for the originator, the attacker. You look for the motive of the killer. Why did we even judge criminally people differently for, was it premeditated? Was it a crime of passion? These things also.
There's also something interesting here of,
yeah,
we're talking about the author, mm-hmm, most importantly, but I think it's also relevant to bring up these same questions to the reader.
When
he says, hey, the reader is not personal. It is not your interpretation. I think that's incredibly silly. When you actually read something, and you feel a certain way about it, the point of a conversation with someone else is to understand why you think this way. Why did I interpret it this way? What meaning did I take from it? Is it because of my past? Is it because of the place that I was reading it at that it inspired this idea? Was it my connection with the music I was listening to at the time? And that is something to explore as well. Why did you interpret it that way?
Why did you not enjoy the book maybe at this time in life? What, were you a different age? Did you just get out of reading a book that you hated and you were just in a bad mood? Did you read something and were you compelled to?
The book going through an experience that ultimately you could not relate to, and so you felt disconnected from the story being told? Maybe the author didn't do a good enough job explaining a situation that someone not in that experience could understand, or the reader is just so far removed from the situation that they can't relate. But all these are questions of man. This is questions of interpretation, author. It's all about understanding.
Yes. What he's asking does seem impossible.
Yes.
And that's okay. A couple examples here of things that we definitely agree on. When we're reading something in a book and you feel as if you're taken out of the book.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of that and I go, oh, I was just taken out of the book. Often when that happens in books, it is because I feel the author's presence. I feel that a story was happening. What a fantastic author can make you forget the author exists. That's another point of this. An author can play this magic act of going, I brought you into the secondary world. You're not thinking of Tolkien the whole time you're reading Middle Earth, but that's a real place. You're not thinking of them because they're doing the job correctly. Now, when you're taken out and you feel that something's being pandered to you, or you feel that a joke is off base or something is strange, or and Wind and Truth, not giving spoilers parts, but there were parts where I felt, oh, Sanderson is writing this, right? Okay, this feels like that was put in by an author. Even when you think that and you're reading a text, that just goes to show that the text didn't just pop up and appear there, and without you feeling that loss of immersion in a fantasy or sci-fi book, often that loss of immersion is because, oh, I feel the author's existence. I feel the real world again because their magic act didn't work in this portion for me. So it's even one of those examples of how an author is definitely in their intent is important, because that the pandering portion you read in a book or in a lot of movies didn't just appear. It appeared because, oh, now it's making me think of the real world. They're making like a one-to-one analogy about the thing, which I don't want to. Okay.
Or they're using an analogy that ultimately does not fit the story that they are telling here.
And it just feels out of place.
This is, yeah. We are taking a step. We're taking a sidestep out of the story to bring up this point that the author shoehorned in.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm getting through almost all my examples here. The conversation then comes to the separating the art versus the artist. Because people often overlap these and they'll say separate the art versus the artist is, hey, the death of the author. It's not connected to the artist whatsoever. We've had several episodes on this, on separating the art versus the artist. What are your thoughts on the overlap, on your views of death of the author versus separating the art versus the artist? What do you have to say about those?
I understand why they're tied together.
Yeah.
And it's often used in reference that it is not the author's intention that matters. So when you look at authors, artists that have done, you know, written a great work or produced an art of great value, and then you find out later that they are of terrible character to your own sensibilities, are you still allowed to enjoy the work? Is that work still on its own? The idea of separating the art versus the artist is, hey, the art can make you feel a certain way. It is, once it is outside of the author's hand, it can also be yours, the reader's, and that you don't have to bring moral judgment to a work like you would the author. They're not inherently linked. Just because the author is a terrible person doesn't mean all of a sudden the work becomes a terrible, awful piece of work. But to this point, I do find them incredibly separate ideas. Like, the author still meant something by it, just because you don't have to ascribe a moral value the same way you would to a person, to a piece of art, doesn't mean that now all of a sudden the author had no value behind the work and meant nothing behind it, and you just judge the words. I don't know. I find that a silly conflation.
Yeah, and you see it in defense because as soon as you hear death of the author, okay, not important, that I'm able to separate fully behind this. Now, the idea to me, what also makes it very different of, to your point, separating the art versus the artist, when that is being said, there's different conversations of, hey, should you still support monetarily the artist? Can you separate the artist from the artist? Should you? A lot of different questions to ask. The base component of it is when, okay, the personal opinion on separating artist versus artist, how much does their personal grievance or whatever happen to make you dislike the author, or how much of what they're doing impacts the art?
Basically, so, for example, it is a moral question rather than a understanding question. One is emotion, one is logic. The whole death of the author is ascribing, like, there is no logic, there is no internal consistency to any type of work, and separating the art from the artist is, do you ascribe the same moral value and moral weight and emotions behind the author and the work itself?
Right.
And how much does it bleed over? Can you separate it? Can you condemn the author while praising the work?
Right.
How much does it remind you? All these questions.
Got to bring up the H word, Hitler, right?
Yep.
Got to always bring up the H word. Just to give the most extreme example of it, of what we're talking about separating the art versus the artist, is how much in one of Hitler's paintings that he painted, how much of his hatred toward Jews and how much of his everything awful about Hitler and genocides and war, how much of all of that was to do with him painting the sky or whatever, just to give an example, or of him loving dogs.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of Hitler liking dogs or Hitler having this painting, how much of that work? And that's the extreme example to give in a modern day. People have things about Kanye, J.K. Rowling. These people are not equivalent
with
Hitler.
They are not the same.
No, no, no.
They are not the same.
None of these are. These are complete. One person has
unequal equivalencies.
Yeah, very unequal equivalencies. Neil Gaiman. So I just described people there of like Kanye saying, I'm not up to date on Kanye stuff, but he's probably said a lot of shit.
He has said some things we can't even get close to on this channel.
Yeah.
Not even close.
Also not equivalent because like even J.K. Rowling saying,
I miss the old Kanye.
I miss the old Kanye.
It's such a perfect song. Oh, God. What?
Damn it.
It's that alone where you go, man, maybe Kanye was touched by some musical god. Like, there's some kind of providence in his works.
Or the devil, some would say.
Yeah, something. But someone was speaking on high for the, whatever.
But again, hey, can you appreciate a Kanye song? And then whatever he's saying now, that does that ruin Kanye music for you? And so these are all false equivalencies of Neil Gaiman committing assaults, sexual assaults, versus J.K. Rowling saying words. You can have your own feelings of, do you, again, those are very different situations because one's words that you could agree or disagree with, another's immoral actions.
Actions of harm.
Many different examples, but point being with separating the art versus the artist and the death of the author, the overlap is very clear on why you'd see that. I'd say the distinguishing factors, which we're getting to, is can you disagree with the death of the author and still separate the art versus the artist? Yes, but it takes some thought of why do you feel so? Mm-hmm. Because, again, personal thought would be how much of that work you're looking at or enjoying. This doesn't have to do with supporting monetarily the author, but how much of the work you're enjoying has to do with the thing they're doing and the outside of the book, of the movie, of the song. How much of that, listening to Gold Digger, how much of that has to do with Kanye, what he's saying now versus him, how much of that has to do with it?
With specifically Neil Gaiman, if you go back to our video on American Gods, there's a specific aspect to that novel that my understanding of Neil Gaiman and all of the different accusations, and a little bit stronger than accusations at a certain point, but all the things that he's been accused of doing and some he has admitted to, throws some of the aspects of the novel into a new context where I couldn't separate it completely, or I'm looking at a character's actions and going, I think this character's actions are not entirely separate from what the author believes, and it's like, what is the intention? Does the author see this as moral or immoral? Is it an expression of condemnation or as a an interpretation of support, but that was a factor I couldn't separate, and it caused me the questions. What was the author's intention? What was his inspiration behind this?
How much does Tarantino loving feet have me to do with how much do you affect your viewing of a Tarantino film? Or here's a better example of Tarantino in Pulp Fiction says the N-word.
Yeah.
He says the N-word, and he actually wrote it in and said it himself in the script. So, all right, Tarantino. But Tarantino says that N-word. If it's to come out today that he's a vulgar racist and just looks down upon black people completely, you then watch Pulp Fiction and go, oh, that you look at it differently. Now, if you look in Tarantino and go, wait, he created the Django Unchained, which is also another movie. Anyways, Pulp Fiction, where he says the N-word, you look at that and go, well, if you're looking at that and you know at least the intent of Tarantino, you don't think he's a... I don't know much about Tarantino, but point is the context of the author can also impact your interpretation of whether you take what they're saying to be even racist, or if you take it to be being said of he's saying that word for the movie, for the art's sake, whether you agree or disagree with that or not.
You want to get tiny aside controversial. I don't think it
this
is.
This whole episode is controversial. What do you mean?
But the point is, like, the N-word itself is actually in an interesting position in at least American cultural zeitgeist and meaning. It is one of those words that exists beyond the person who says it and what their intention is. Because
that's another important thing. Yeah.
It is something that, depending on the color of your skin and its meaning, almost like your understanding, your meaning behind the word doesn't matter. So I remember in high school, like, there was some degree of understanding of if you were reading, like, people reading Huckleberry Finn out loud in class, you say the word and everyone kind of has an understanding of, is the person saying the word saying it out of malice to another person? Because that's the point of the word, is like, is it said out of malice, or is it reading the text of that's what it says? It's not made out of malice. It's not to denigrate someone. But then now in the zeitgeist, like, it doesn't matter what context you say the word. It is just saying the word, you ascribe value and meaning of, oh, it was said in a negative context. Like, I don't know. It's one of those words that's really silly.
It's one of the most complicated words too, because when it comes to this whole death of the author, that take that word, and then if you take for what Barthes is saying, you just read it for its language on the page, versus if you then you had a point there.
Yeah, it's just the reason why I do not say it. There's two things. It's almost separative. I my feeling of why I would never call a black person the N-word is because I do not hold the hatred feeling. I do not want to denigrate someone that way. That's one reason not to say the word. The other reason, the reason I say the N-word in different contexts, where I will never say it like out loud on film, regardless of the context, is not out of my own personal feelings. It's like the understanding of the culture is like, it doesn't matter what context I say it. It will still be taken in the worst possible light. And so it's something I disagree with, but acquiesce to the culture.
Well, the whole thing is the point of language we're getting at is the author means something, the reader interprets something. And you're saying, if you say something,
That word will be interpreted one way, and that's the understanding. And so me saying it almost doesn't, it's a tool to be understood. And I know how it will be understood. And so you don't say it.
So it, again, kind of comes to the author-reader relationship of language is more than just that. You have to look at, that's a great example to look at the before and after of the language itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Barth is stupid. another point to make. Okay, lighter topic to get into. You know, we passed the separating art versus the artist, and we're okay. Let's get to lighter topic is self-insert character.
This video is going to be shadow banned. I hope you know that.
Oh, I mean, we're getting viewers. No,
no nobody, viewers nobody. At all.
So the self-insert characters that you ever read a book quote from Kingkiller Chronicles, or you read something and go, huh, this feels oddly as if the author was very present when writing this. It's just another thought that you have sometimes when you're taken out of a book going, oh, Yeah, this is the author. There's something. There was some finagling here. Last thing. Okay, I keep saying that. I have more. The story beats. This is a point to make where we talked in our classic versus, sorry, our cliche versus trope video that hasn't come out yet because we have that stored up. But an important thing about even when reading a classic book and you look at tropes, you look at different cliches, something that was written at the time may, in our modern sense, feel trite or feel cliche. And you could have a certain view of that literary tool that was used. But back then, it was more revolutionary. It was new. It was different. That doesn't mean it can't be eclipsed in the future. That doesn't mean that you have to love the original work. But it even helps to have context of what literary tools were in the tool belt at the time of what could humans write in 1950 or in 19... What was available? So even in a part of interpretation or appreciating and being a literary critic, which at this point you can see that's we are not. So looking at that can even change and impact your read or appreciation or understanding of work. I just think everything Barthes says here leads to more interpretive paralysis in that sense of it leads to less fun conversations or less intelligent conversations about works of art. Yes, people can still interpret things very differently. That's just as fun. And based on your personal experiences, and that's just as fun. But it leaves you in this weird standstill the entire time that is almost impossible to remedy because the reader leave all of your personal biases out of it. And also the author doesn't exist and the origin of that doesn't exist. It's this, sorry, you had something? Oh yeah, muting that. But it leaves you in that very, very strange place. And we've already given an infinite number of examples, but a current debate that I see often enough, it happens in our Patreon, which by the way, if you want to join our book club where we talk a book every month and hey, maybe essays, we can start talking now, join that description below. It helps, it supports the channel. So another big one is Lord of the Rings. I see this as a common thing of Tolkien, some people calling Tolkien racist, of reading into the orcs and saying the orcs represent these others. This represents the East and it represents, what do they say? Orcs represents...
Basically, orcs represent brown-skinned people.
Brown-skinned people and just anybody and that's not Eastern, England, essentially.
Especially the Eastlanders are, you know, described as darker skin and they are the ones that side with Sauron during the war.
Right. That is something that is said there. Now, is it important to understand... Now, you could interpret it that way as a reader. I don't think that's correct.
But here's something I think is the valid up until the certain point of you can take that as like, that is my interpretation of the work where you go the step beyond where, oh, now you need to kind of have some proof to it of we're getting into the point of objectivity of ascribing the author of like not. It's one thing to even say like I interpreted the Lord of the Rings as racist. That is actually, I think, far more valid of a statement than saying like I interpret like Tolkien. The Lord of the Rings is racist and Tolkien is racist. That's very different. Now you're going, no. It's one thing to have an interpretation of a work. It's another thing to go like, now I'm going to talk about the author's intention.
You're doing both.
And then it's like, no, we can understand like, okay, if we're going to talk about the author's intention, let's talk about the author's intention, not your interpretation and ascribing it to the author's intention. Like, then we're starting to get into the actual objective debate. You can investigate that.
Right.
But just because you interpret something some way doesn't mean it's what the author intended it. It doesn't become backward compatible.
And I would say that interpretation can come off of personal biases and you can read into that. And that's why a reader might feel that in Tolkien and see the orcs as...
If you read that black people are the orcs, it may say something more about you than Tolkien.
I would say it has to be personal bias there. However, let's say it's Barth's example here. If you read into that and you're not using personal bias, you're reading the text for what it is. Oh, orcs are clearly... Eastern orcs are clearly not England, or they're darker skinned, and they are
to steel man. That idea is orcs being the corruption of the fair skinned elves, and ultimately they are a perversion of what is good, and so you know corruption. So maybe you take it that way.
Yes,
and so because elves are light skinned and orcs are a variety of different shades of color, there's not really, they're just not fair skinned. They're a corruption of elves. And so if you happen to see black people as a corruption of white people, maybe that's how you interpret it. I personally don't interpret it that way because I don't see dark-skinned people as a perversion, but whatever.
And, well, the people reading it are then attributing that to, oh, maybe this is what Tolkien thinks, that Tolkien is projecting this into the work. That's where, yeah, it's weird because it's not just the interpretation. You're saying it's also their this is their interpretation and then attributing that to the author of what they meant by the text. So it's a double whammy.
There's almost two separate conversations there. It's one thing to have a conversation, well, why did you interpret it this way? And we could talk about the relationship of you and the text.
Yep.
And then it's the step too far is ascribing that to the author's intention, where it's like, okay, no, the author's intention is what the author intended. And that you can get it right or wrong based on available information, but the author has an intention. And so you, if there is available text, that is something to investigate.
There, maybe even a better example, too, because you're right in that interpretation part. Because we think Tolkien did not clearly mean that, and people could disagree and go, hey, I think
there
he did that mean that.
There is plenty of textual evidence that he did not.
And that would be using Barthstein. You're using the context. You're using the text itself to say, hey, look
no,
at this.
I'm not looking at text. I'm looking at writings that he said about the text. Although he explained
so you're looking at
himself.
Tolkien saying this, yeah.
Like, explicitly, this is what I mean.
Well, okay, now here's a point. Here's a good example of just because an author means something doesn't mean it comes across correctly. Where Dune Book One with Frank Herbert wanted people to leave the end of Book One with Dune and look at, hey, Paul Atreides, this is a warning.
Be wary of the charismatic leaders.
And this religious zealot that could have power. And then, yes, be wary of these figures. However, many people read that interpreted of, oh, yes, let's go Paul Atreides. What a hero redemption. Let's go. Now, how would you react to that and interpret that with Barth's argument? Do you think this is where Barth has a point, or do you still object?
Yeah, I object, because two things could be true at once. Someone can have an interpretation of what they took from it, and then you can then say, hey, okay, That's how that person interpreted it. And why did they? You can have the conversation of why they interpreted it that way. Fair enough. What did the author intend? And that's ultimately like the point of like, okay, what was their intention? Oh, maybe it was misconstrued this way, and that's why this other person interprets it that other way. But there is some hierarchy to these things.
It's important for the art form itself. Look at me doing art form. It's important for the art form. Stupid. So it's important for the text as well of even if I think that's okay. I wanted to use that example, not the orc one, because I think the Dune one's very valid. It's can read like that very much so as an interpretation. And I think that both can be true where the reader interprets this text and sees Paul as this hero and doesn't pick up or doesn't hey, Frank Herbert maybe didn't do a good enough job of making that clear enough to this was the message of the story. But what makes that valuable is if you know the author intended to have this message takeaway and you didn't, that can either increase or decrease your how much you liked it. Because I know, for example, in the film Your Name ends, I will not say the ending because it's a newer film and also it's incredible. The ending of Your Name, you told me that the director cut it short and they wanted to actually add more to the movie.
They were very upset with the ending of their movie.
I think it's the perfect ending. I think it is a magical, five-star, devastatingly beautiful film, Your Name. And the fact that it didn't go a second longer is perfect. Now, the author intended, it wanted more and kind of felt bad and went, damn it, I cut it short. To me, it was perfect. Now, it's still incredible, even though I know the director wanted to continue on and have more added on to that ending, which shouldn't have been. I'm glad the author stopped short. The point of these being of even though the author intends or unconsciously includes something into a work that moves you to tears or makes you feel something, both the reader and author are important in that equation, especially when it just comes to talking about a work. Because then if everything is, hey, taking our personal opinions aside, because we can have our personal feelings, as Barth says, but if everything is just reader's interpretation for what the text is, and this post-structuralist argument is that everything is completely fluid, well, yes, we know there's subjective opinions about things, but there is an objective truth to what the author means. That does not mean that we know for certain. The author could lie about what they mean, but it adds to...
The author could be wrong in their vision of the world of like, yeah, that's what they intend, but ultimately they're, because of their view on the world, it is a disharmonious piece of work. And ultimately that's kind of the fun, is often a good artist will intend one thing, and ultimately because they are, you know, in reality, they will give across a different message. Yeah. And it's fun to interpret it that way of like, oh, I got it this way. And it's fun to interpret it, but it's also their intention matters. We're getting at it.
Yes, it does. And how much of this whole conversation do we have? And hopefully we made our points clear. Because
I hope so.
The point with that being, someone could then watch this video and go, man, they just...
Man, Richard just really wants to say the N-word.
I was going to say the same joke. Damn it, you beat me to it. that could be their interpretation of it and go and take away. Now, do you mean something else? How much does that matter in it? Point being, this essay, I think when Barthes is writing this, he pulled the trigger and was going like, oh, look at me. I'm going to have this... Okay, I'm attributing meaning when he didn't actually mean this. Okay, I'll make the point that he's making of in order to read works, read it for the language that's on there. Reader, don't be personal. Take away your personal history. Take away the author's personal history. Be a robot. Am I misinterpreting him? Who the fuck cares? He doesn't.
Well, I'm glad you made me read this essay and we got to just pontificate about why this French guy is wrong.
Now my honest thoughts are this. This enraged me. This whole thing, I'm reading this thinking, okay, if I'm interpreting this, if I'm getting the text across correctly, it enraged me because the whole thing was just contradictory to itself. I couldn't get out of my head that I'm reading a translation that was, sorry, I'm saying this for the third time, but let me get this across again.
Third.
Fourth time. I'm reading a translation of a work that is supposed to convey what Roland Barthes thought. He does not exit the French language unless somebody tries to interpret what he means so we can read and understand Roland Barthes. How it's insane. Did he not think one step further? I'm so disappointed. I'm so disappointed. It's
fair enough. Thank you everyone for watching and listening to us. We hope we made you think something. Maybe. Bye everyone.
Bye.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.